Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, who were the Subotnikim and what was their role in the settlement of the Land of Israel? Most people have heard of the kibbutz, a collectively owned and run community which holds a storied place in Israeli culture, and many Jews and non-Jews from around the world have volunteered on them. Less is known about the moshav and moshavah, which are also agricultural communities but very different in their philosophy and organization. Ami Bar is an Israeli historian and archaeologist who made Aliyah from the eastern plains of Colombia in 1967. He's a member of Kibbutz Gonen in the northwest of Israel and spoke with us about the three types of agricultural communities. Thank you very much for speaking with us today, Ami. I was wondering if you could begin by giving us a brief definition of the three terms, kibbutz, moshav, and moshavah, because I don't think that most people know the difference or even have heard of a moshav or a moshavah.
Okay, let's start with the kibbutz, which is the best known of them all the world over. That doesn't mean that it's the most numerous in Israel. There are 258 kibbutzim, and there are 459 moshavim. The kibbutz is a form of settlement in the land that is communal, socialistic, where the means of production are owned communally. They are belong to all the community. It is not a cooperative. It is much more than that. It is communal in the full sense of the word. That is, there is no private property or the means of production. The means of production by which they make their living are the land or the machinery or the tractors or the factories that kibbutz has and has been around since 1915, more or less. And then there is the moshav, which is more numerous than the kibbutz, but lesser known. The moshav is a cooperative. It's a form of settlement in the land that is a cooperative. That is, the members of the moshav, unlike those of the kibbutz, have ownership, private ownership of the means of production. They have 3.6 hectares of land per family, and they own the tractors, the machinery. And they have no factories in the moshavim. The difference between them and the kibbutz is that the machinery or the means of marketing and buying seeds or agricultural equipment are done in common, cooperative, like a cooperative. That is, they use, if they need a heavy tractor, which most of them do not have, then they buy a heavy tractor, and the heavy tractor will be used by all the members of the moshav. Besides that, every family has their own little tractors, smaller tractors. Because of the way they work the land, they usually do not need big tractors the way the kibbutz do. Kibbutz usually have big tractors.
So each family works its own little piece of land.
That's right. They have their own piece of land. They have their own house, which belongs to them. They can sell it or buy it. If anybody buys in, it wants to be in, they have to go through a selection process. Not just anybody can go and live in a moshav. In the same way as a kibbutz, if you want to enter a kibbutz, you have to go through a selection process. You have to go through a battery of tests in both cases, in kibbutz and moshav.
And a moshavah?
And the moshavah, which is the lesser known, but the oldest of all the forms of settlement in the land in Israel, is from the 19th century. The settlers, the people who came to settle the land in the moshavah, Like in an agricultural town in Europe, because that's where it was copied from. Each family owns the land, but they own the means of production and the tractors and everything. There is nothing cooperative there. The Moshava is complete private ownership. There is no cooperativism. There is no sharing of machinery. Nothing is completely private. And it has a much more, I'd say, much more interesting story than the other two movements.
So can you tell us about the story of all three movements, how they began, when, by whom they were created?
Let's start chronologically. Let's start with the oldest one, the Moshava. You know about the pogroms in Russia in the 1880s, when almost a million Jews left for Western Europe and for the United States. Much less is known about those who left for Israel in the same years, 1880s. The ones who'd go to Eretz Israel were mostly Mesoratim, traditional Jews, who were Orthodox, not ultra-Orthodox, Orthodox. What you could call today modern Orthodox. That is, they didn't dress up like ultra-Orthodox, but they were religious, quite religious. They were very quite observant. And when they started coming because of the pogroms in Eastern Europe, in Russia, in Tsarist Russia, there were several associations that were created with the purpose of coming to Eretz Israel. There was the Hovevei Zion, Lovers of Zion. There were the Bilu, Beit Israel Yale, that is the House of Israel, will go up. And then there were innumerable agricultural associations coming especially from the area around Moldavia and Romania to Eretz Israel in the small agricultural associations. And we have close to 28 Moshavot in the country. The oldest one is the one in the north, the one by the name of Rosh Pina, 1878, first one. The second one is Petah Tikva, which is in the center of the country and today is no longer a Moshava, but a town, a city, very close to Tel Aviv. And then there are many others like Metula, Yesod HaMa'ala, Rishon LeZion, which were set up by these agricultural organizations.
But I was under the impression that in Russia and in Eastern Europe in general, the Jews didn't work the land.
That's quite right. That's quite true.
How were they able to set up agricultural communities?
That was the major problem that they had when they arrived in Israel. They didn't know the slightest idea about how to work the land, because since the Jews were dispossessed of the land already by the 6th century under Justinian's law, about 570, when he disposed that the Jews couldn't work the land by themselves, couldn't work the land through a second person or third person, or they could do nothing with the land. And this is when there were some Jews still living in the land. The idea was, of course, to dispossess the Jews of the land. So when they were in Europe, they had no access to the land, except in Muslim Spain, which was not Christian. All these laws were meant to be followed in Christian Europe. So the first Moshava, which is Rosh Pina, failed. The first attempt at settlement of 1878 failed. Because they didn't know how to work the land, they started to imitate the Bedouins who lived in the town, in a village near Rosh Pina, and they failed miserably. They couldn't make a living out of working the land because they had never worked the land because of anti-Jewish legislation in Europe. So the salvation came from a group called the Subotnikim. And this is where history becomes very interesting. The Subotnikim were Jews who were only a little bit before Napoleon arrived in Russia. They were Christians who observed Shabbat. Shabbat was observed in Christianity until the 6th century. And then the church decided they wouldn't observe the Shabbat anymore, but the Sundays. Except for a few churches here and there who kept observing the Shabbat. And these people were called Sobotnikim, from the word Shabbat in Russian. So they were called Sobotniks, Sobotnikim in Hebrew. So somewhere around the 18th century, many of the Sobotnikim converted to Judaism. Nobody knows why they converted. The thing is that when Napoleon arrived in Russia, you know, Napoleon was very, very enlightened conqueror, and he carried around an army of scientific people who told him, informed him, along the Don and the Dnieper, along the border between Moldavia and Russia, there are many Subotnikim who converted to Judaism only 100 years ago. And that is the first mention we have of the Subotnikim, thanks to Napoleon. So the Ishuv is the Jewish population living in the land in 1880. That's what they are called in Hebrew. The Ishuv knew that these Subotnikim exist in Russia. So they sent a delegation, the leaders of the Ishuv, that's what we call the country in Eretz Israel, before the First World War, they sent a delegation to Odessa. This delegation went to Odessa and started looking for how can we find these Subotnikim, and they found them immediately. They brought them to Israel, some 150 families, and the idea was that these Subotnikim, who were peasants, because they had been Christians once upon a time, who knew how to work the land, would teach the Jews in the Moshavot how to work the land. And that's how it happened. The Subotnikim, besides that, fit completely the new settlers in the Moshavot because they were also observant and religious Jews. So they even dressed the same way. So you have the first Moshavot being settled by Jewish families and by Subotnikim. And the Subotnikim trained the Jewish families in how to work the land. And that went over all over the 20-something Moshavot in the country.
So this began in 1878, the first Moshavah. And how have the Moshavot developed since then, and what is the situation of them now?
The last Moshavot were founded in 19-something, in the Kfar Tabor or Metula, that very late. And this time they already they were in a much better situation because they already knew how to work the land, thanks to the Subotnikim, and because Baron Edmond de Rothschild was helping them financially and sending them agricultural guides. We're telling them how to grow wine, how to grow this, how to grow that, how to grow grapes, how to grow whatever. So they were, in this time, they already had help. So they prospered. But since the 20s, in the 20th century, we haven't had any new Moshavot.
So have they developed and prospered, and what is their situation now?
The situation, some of them have become cities, like Metula, which is half a Moshavah, half a city, like Rosh Pina, like Petach Tikva, like Rishon LeZion, who have become a city, and some of them are still Moshavot.
Do the kids who grow up there tend to stay, or do they, I mean, is there a problem with aging and the kids move away because they want to go live in a city or something?
No, it's quite the contrary. There is a lot of demand to live in Moshavot. Because for somebody who doesn't like the idea of being a socialist in a kibbutz or in a moshav, likes the idea of being in an agricultural town like in Western Europe. And that's what they are. I mean, they have their fields next to their houses, like in Europe.
Okay, so then tell us about the moshav. How did they start and how did they develop?
The first moshav was founded immediately after the First World War in the 20s. And the first moshav was Nahalal. By coincidence, the moshav of Moshe Dayan. And they are today 458 moshavim, many more than kibbutzim, except that they never carried the political weight that the kibbutzim had, because they were more dedicated to agriculture.
So who started them and why? How were they created?
They were created by kibbutznikim who left kibbutzim, who didn't want to live such a socialistic life.
Okay, so tell us about the kibbutzim. When were they first created and by whom? And tell us about them and how they developed.
The first kibbutz was founded in 1915. And it was a very well organized, some say too organized, settlement. The first kibbutz that we have is the Gania. The second is Kinneret, one next to the other. And then we have the third one is Kfar Giladi, up in the Hula Valley.
Who were these people who started the kibbutz, and where did they get their ideas from?
The people who founded the kibbutzim were intellectual Jews coming from Russia in what is called the Second Aliyah. They came here in 1905 when the failed revolution, the failed socialist revolution took place in Russia, when the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks voted or wanted to take power, the Mensheviks lost. Many of these Mensheviks ended up in Israel. They came to live in Israel. The idea of the Mensheviks, which means the minority in Russian, was to create a socialistic society by democratic means, like social democrats in Europe today. Well, the Bolsheviks was creating a socialist society by force, which that's what they did in 1917. So when the Mensheviks arrived in 1905, they started organizing themselves in little nucleuses, in nucleus here, nucleus there, and the first kibbutz was founded in 1915. Gania. And since then, the rest is history.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the structure was like and how the kibbutz was organized?
Yes, it was very structured. There was no private property at all. The closest thing to what we have in the kibbutz, you have it in Soviet Russia, in the sovkhoz and the kolkhoz, but they were not as socialistic as the kibbutz is. So in the case of the kibbutz, they worked in teams, they were trained agriculturally, and not even the clothes they had were private. They used to use each other's work clothes. There was no private clothes. And whatever they brought from Russia, they had to donate to the comuna. And of course, there was no private property on the means of production, the lands, the horses, the mules.
So how did the movement develop and how many kibbutzim were there at the height?
In the second Aliyah, or the people who liked the idea of setting up a kibbutz, that is, who shared their ideas of socialism, the Mensheviks, were a lot. And they came and they kept coming from a little bit before the First World War until the 20s of the 20th century. And they very rapidly they set up kibbutzim, especially in the valley of Israel, which is in the north of the country, the area where today is the city of Afula, more or less. And very soon there were 30 kibbutzim, 40 kibbutzim, 50 kibbutzim. When the Second World War started, there were already 150 kibbutzim. Today, there are 258 kibbutzim.
And so were all these people originally from Russia or from the Soviet Union?
Yes, the founders in the 30s were mostly from the Soviet Union. The kibbutzim founded after the Second World War, there you already had Holocaust survivors or partisans from Vilna, from Lithuania, Letonia, Estonia, from Bulgaria, from Romania, from Hungary. So you have kibbutzim who are were founded by Hungarians, by Russians, by Romanians. Of course, they are today Sabra kibbutzim because the grandsons are Sabras. But that's how it started. Most of the Jews coming at that time were from Russia and Poland.
So what happened? People arrived in Israel, and were they already groups and they said, let's go start a kibbutz, or they joined other kibbutzim that were already in operation? In other words, how did people form a new kibbutz? They must have had to ask somebody to let them use the land for this kibbutz.
When they were in Europe, they were already in youth movements, Zionist socialist youth movements, like the Hashomer HaTzair, like the Hapoel. So they already were members of an organization even before they came to Israel. So they were expected, and everything was ready for them to come to settle up a new kibbutz. And the organization in charge of absorbing them in the country was, it was the national leadership of the country, which was the Jewish National Fund at that time. And there were cases when they wouldn't, especially with the Holocaust survivors, were not members of youth movements, but had been organized into groups by members of the Jewish Brigade, which is an Israeli, Eretz Israel Brigade, operating in occupied Europe at the time, occupied by the Allies, not by Nazis, by the Allies. So they were being helped by the Jewish Brigade to come to Israel, and they have preference over everybody, but they were coming to set up new kibbutzim. And at this time, what they knew already, that what would fix the borders, where the kibbutz would be, that would be the border.
Now, I think most people have the idea that in a kibbutz, for example, the children don't live with their families. The children have their own special house, and that's where they grow up, and maybe they see their families from time to time. Is this the way it is? Is this the way it used to be? How has the actual structure of a kibbutz evolved?
That was the case. In the far of the 50s and the 60s of the 20th century, the children had their own little houses and their own activities. They were busy the whole day around, and they would see their parents 1 or 2 hours a day after dinner. And they would be put into bed by the parents in their children's houses. But that has changed in the 70s, little by little. The kibbutzim started adopting the idea of children, it would be better for the children if they slept at their parents' home. And that is the case today. There is not even one kibbutz in the whole country where the children sleep in their own little houses. They sleep with their parents today.
It's very interesting that that's changed, because that was something that people thought of as being such a signature thing of the kibbutzim.
Yes.
How else have the kibbutzim changed?
Well, the kibbutzim have changed because they are something that were unthinkable, like the ownership of private property like the ownership of cars, that is unthinkable in a kibbutz. And today, except for some 80 kibbutzim, all the rest of the kibbutzim have gone in the opposite way. That is, they are less socialistic and more like a cooperative. The means of production, though, are still the ownership of the kibbutz. They don't belong. The means of production do not belong to the members. They belong to the kibbutz. They still are the property of the kibbutz.
And they're not only strictly agricultural anymore, are they?
No. Most kibbutzim today have some kind of industry or factory.
How many kibbutzim are there?
258.
Where do you see the movement going? Do you think that there will be more or fewer, or what's happening with the kibbutzim?
It would be very difficult to think that there will be more kibbutzim, because the political regime in Israel doesn't want more kibbutzim, the opposite. The Likud, the political party in power, doesn't, and has said so, we don't want more kibbutzim. We want more moshavim, more moshavot, which are not socialistic. They are cooperative or capitalistic in nature.
But there are also, I understand, urban kibbutzim, aren't there, that are not agricultural at all? How do they work?
That's right. Because they couldn't get land or help from the state because of the political party in power today, then they started founding urban kibbutzim, in which they live together in the town, like in Haifa or in Sderot, and they work at the outside and they bring their salaries to the communal box. There's some 15 kibbutzim, urban kibbutzim today.
Okay, so tell us now about a moshav.
Okay, the moshav, unlike the kibbutz, didn't have the political weight that the kibbutz had. In the kibbutz, you could say that the people who came to live in a kibbutz were busy, not just with agriculture, but with politics, and with philosophy, and with art, and with everything else. In the moshav, the people in the moshav were much more into agriculture.
When did the moshav start? When were they first created?
It was created in the 20s. The first moshav was Nachalal. By coincidence, the moshav of Moshe Dayan. Moshe Dayan was, his family was from Degania, the first kibbutz. They were not happy with living in such an organized settlement, so they went to the first moshav, Nachalal, and settled it.
And how did the movement of the moshav develop, and where did the people come from?
The moshav is much more numerous than the kibbutz. There is about 458 moshavim in the country. Most of the agricultural production comes from the moshav. They are the biggest form of settlement in Israel. And the second one is the kibbutz. The moshav produces more vegetables and fruits than the kibbutz. And the kibbutz specializes in different types of agriculture, like corn, like wheat, like cotton. They practice a different kind of agriculture. The moshav, of course, has the biggest number of population in the land, and much more than the kibbutz.
Where did these people come from?
The first moshavim, until the Second World War, were peopled by people from Europe, from Western Europe or Eastern Europe. And the population that came after the Second World War came from Arab countries, mostly from Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, Iraq, Yemen. There is one Yemenite moshav very, very near my kibbutz, for instance.
And were these people also organized in their original countries the way the people were who later formed the kibbutzim?
No, they were not organized. In many cases, they were not even asked where they wanted to live, unlike the kibbutzim, who knew where they were going to be in which kibbutz the people of the Moshavim, especially those coming in the mass aliyah of the 50s from North Africa and from Yemen, were brought in trucks to those Moshavim and put there in the land in tents, because there were no houses at that time. And then they were brought agricultural guides who trained them into agriculture. And that's why there are so many Moshavnikim in Israel who are from Yemen or from Arab countries.
So it sounds like the different kinds of, let's say, agricultural structures or agricultural settlements, if you want to call them that, the people have come from very, very different backgrounds. Do they have any kind of relationship among themselves, other than, let's say, when all their kids go to school or go to the army or whatever?
Yes, it was much easier getting a group of people to live in a moshav than living in a kibbutz. When they were asked, I'm talking about the moshavnikim, do you want to live in this or that or that kibbutz? They said no, because there they don't have synagogues, they don't believe in God. We want synagogues and we believe in God. So there is also a cultural difference, a religious difference, and they didn't believe in socialism. They didn't trust socialism. They thought that is communism. That is atheism. You know, the communists are atheists. And they were.
So what is the situation now, and how do you see the future of each, of the kibbutz, of the moshav, and of the moshava?
Today, the kibbutz movement and the moshav movement cooperate completely. They even belong to the same party, the Labor Party, or the Zionist camp, as it is called today. And there's just about no difference. Each one of them has his buildings. Let's say the kibbutz movement has its own building in Tel Aviv, and next to it is the building of the moshav movement. And they cooperate completely politically, especially politically. And they see political problems in the same way, because they are labor. In both cases, they are labor. The moshavot, that's completely different. The moshavot usually tend to be Likud, that is right wing, and they don't want to hear anything about socialism or cooperativism.
And where do you see this going?
Today, there is cooperation at regional level, not on national level. That is the kibbutzim and the moshavim cooperate with the moshavot at regional level. In my valley, for instance, we have three moshavot. We have Metula, Rosh Pina, and Yesod HaMaala. And they cooperate with the kibbutzim and the moshavim at regional level, at economical level, but not at ideological, not in the Knesset.
But cooperate in what way?
Cooperate in the economic sphere. For instance, if we have a factory and we don't have enough room for a factory, we can ask from a moshava permission to set up the factory there. That sort of stuff. And we have common cultural activities between the moshavot, the kibbutzim, and the moshavim in the same area. And besides that, the kids do not go to the same schools. The kibbutzim and the moshavim do go to the same schools. The moshavot, no, they have their own schools.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you would like to add that we might have left out?
Yes, the land of the kibbutzim and the moshavim, which is most of the agricultural land in the country, doesn't belong to them, belongs to the state, and they pay a symbolic sum of 1 cent per hectare, just to make sure that there will be no the development that happens in the third world, where the rich own a lot of land and the poor do not have any land. So the only private land, that agricultural land that is private in Israel, belongs to the moshavot, which were founded in the 19th century, before the socialists came to the land, and that of the Arab villages. That is completely private, completely capitalistic.
So the land of the Arabs and the land of the Moshavot can be bought and sold?
It can be bought and sold.
To anybody?
To anybody.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is EnglishCorner@RadioSephirot.com. See you next week.